Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Let me call the study session of Monday, October 1st, 2007, to order. The first item is to review items on the agenda for this evening's meeting. Let's go ahead and flip over that in our packets. We have the typical introduction stuff on page one there, page two, some liquor license applications, page three, contracts. Continued on page four, additional contracts. Page five, Mike, I have you down for 4K and a conflict there, okay? Page six, also contracts. Then we get into the introduction of ordinances and setting October 15th. That's continued on page seven. And page eight, we get into resolutions, taking actions on resolutions. That's continued over page nine. See 7F, I pulled, that's the sign, the monument sign, I believe. Okay. Somebody else can make the motion. I've already stated my position on monument signs along freeways, so just want to be consistent. I'm going to go to page 10. Any questions on any of the agenda items? Okay, looks like it's fairly straightforward this evening. We'll see how long this one takes. Item number two is hear an update and discuss.
Yeah, I think we can just skip to
all right.
Number three?
Number three?
And four first.
You want to drop to four? Okay. Four is discuss and provide direction regarding the possible changes to the ethics handbook for elected officials and advisory board members. In our packet, we have a suggestion that's a clarification on elected officials, advisory board members, and candidates shall not engage in political campaigning at city meetings or within in-city buildings. And I think there's a suggestion that we change that to allow non-city sponsored candidate forums and debates and use of city buildings if they're in that category. So if somebody wants to hire a facility, they could in fact use the city building.
That's right, Mayor. It would be leased or rented or provided, given access to in the same terms and conditions that we do to any other organization or citizen looking to use the city facility.
All right. The only caveat a little bit on that is I think city, at least existing council members and stuff, know where there are buildings, so you need a little bit better informed population on whether there's a fire department station that has a city building that they could rent, not knowing that it's marketable, but I don't know how you, whether that gives somebody a heads up or a little advantage or not, but not significant enough. I really have appreciated the forums that we've done that have been paid for with the Republic and the Tribune to let the public get a concept of which candidates are running, and that because we have Channel 11 and it's videotaped in that building and it's all set up for it, is just a natural venue. So I think this would, in my opinion, just be a clarification. I always thought that they were renting the facility, so it was their usage of it, kind of like a hotel room. You have certain rights when you sign that contract. They still need a warrant to enter your room. So
yeah, and Mayor, you're right. They have the right to rent the facilities, and we do. The contradiction in the ethics handbook is with regard to the participation by the candidate in the forum.
Okay. So do you have some suggested language, or if we agree with some type of change, will you come back and then we'll examine that at a later date?
Yes, I'll draft some language and bring it to the council if council directs me to do that.
Okay, discussion on it, Tom?
I was thinking about it, and I guess I'd take a little different take on it. The city building doesn't bother me so much as what goes on. And to me, I'd rather have, you know, obviously not at any city meetings, but something that, when you start talking about, you know, city buildings, does that mean standing in front of the library, which is where I announced when I ran for council? There's a free speech zone there. I specifically stayed out of it because I didn't want to have anybody think that my right to free speech was limited to just to that box. But, you know, I think it's a question of whether or not people disrupt, disturb, or distract from any city business, as opposed to a blanket prohibition on a particular building, because I just don't know you know, what's wrong with having the, you know, campaign's picture taken of you standing in front of the city plaza?
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, I agree that the intent was to avoid disruption. The other thing we've looked at as kind of a guiding factor is, first, how would we enforce that if it just said so that you're not disruptive in a city building? I'm not sure how we would enforce it or who would enforce it, and also avoiding any future claim that by allowing free speech in a city building, you are declaring the entire building a public forum.
Right.
So it's how do we narrow those two issues? So the best we could do was community rooms in a city building, or if it's a non-city sponsored forum.
Again, I think it needs to be changed. I think what you're proposing is better than it is, and so I would certainly support it. I was just trying to think beyond that a little bit to see if there wasn't a way to make it less ambiguous, but I may be, in fact, making it worse. So let me see the language.
And I'll try and take those comments into consideration and see what I can do in terms of drafting it.
Thank you.
Okay. Other discussion on this one? Everyone concur to move forward, and let's do some draft language. Okay. Three? All right. Number three is discuss and provide direction on the process for appointing a council member to fill the vacancy in District 5. Let me make a suggestion here. I'd like to have an open process so that anyone in District 5 certainly has the opportunity to fill out an application and say they're interested, just as we do for council candidates or mayor elections, although you have to grab nomination petitions to prove that you have some type of community support in that aspect of it. I'd like to suggest that we follow something similar to what we've done for the boards and committee appointments, where the everyone in District 5 that's had the two-year residency requirement could do an application that would come to me. I would do the screening and make a recommendation to the council. It does take four votes to approve, because we're six of us now, so it's going to take 3-3 split, I don't believe passes, so we're going to get to four.
It'll still be four, Mayor.
Right. If we do another process in which the applicants come forward, then we're going to have lots of public comment. We're going to have lots of different people supporting different candidates, and I'm not sure, although it's certainly something we can discuss, whether we want to go through that elaborate process for an appointee. I hope that there will be some that will kind of jump off the page on prior city involvement, be up to speed so they can contribute in the 7 months or 8 months that they'll be serving, and have some type of have expressed and shown an interest in Mesa through other involvement with their community in the past. So that's certainly what I would be looking for in an application. We will let me just suggest that as one possibility for consideration here, and let's open it up for discussion. So anybody want to, Mike?
Thank you, Mayor. I don't have any problem with doing that. However, I think maybe in this respect, I would like to see who those names are.
Absolutely.
Before we finally make a determination, or you make a short list, just so that we have a chance to see the resumes and who would apply.
Okay, if we do the resumes and all the applications, then we would have a study session in which they would be discussed, or they would just be...
I don't know how we would do that with public documents, because once they submit, they are a public document.
Councilmember Whalen, you're right. Obviously, we'd redact the personal identification, but the charter doesn't give any direction of the process that the council has to follow. What it says is the council shall appoint within 30 days. So you can really engage in any process you want, obviously taking into consideration the open meeting law. So if you want to have a discussion prior to the shortlist, it would have to be in a public meeting.
I would, as a follow-up, I would suggest that we use Channel 11 to show a map of District 5, give an address for applications, and do something online so that they could pick one up. Basically, it would be the same as a board or committee application, which has some different questions in there. The one thing I would like to also be as a question that would be a little bit unique is just, you know, what do they see their term of service accomplishing? What do they have to offer to the community that would show that that is the candidate that should be appointed as an interim? What are the qualifications that they offer that others may not? Kind of an open-ended question, so see, people can take it wherever they want, but it'll give me a better idea of what their goals and aspirations of that 7 months of service are. And I don't quite have that on the boards or committee application. So, all right, who's next? Tom, would you?
I would defer to Vice Mayor.
All right, Vice Mayor?
The comment I wanted to make was in regards to another piece that I think should be out there, which is what it actually takes to do this job. I think that would be a good information piece for people. They may not really understand. They see us sitting here a couple of times a month in the regular meetings. They see us sitting here every Thursday in the study sessions. And I know I've had people who have said to me that they assumed that that was the full extent of what we do. And that probably doesn't reflect accurately how many hours it takes. I would say that, you know, having had the experience of being maybe, the only person up here who has been appointed, I was at one point in time, back in 1997, in November of 1997, I was appointed to serve out the balance of somebody's term. It was a seven-month appointment, and the learning curve is pretty steep. And I had come from having been on the school board and having served, and there's a lot to learn, and there's a lot to learn very fast. And so I would anticipate that this job is going to take somebody somewhere between 20 to 50 hours a week, depending on how much constituent involvement they have. And they need to anticipate that it's going to take that much time.
Good point. Okay, Tom.
Mayor, I'm a little uncomfortable with what you're proposing, because I think making it too much like the boards and commission thing, where you under the charter have the authority specifically to make recommendation approved by the council. Here the language of the charter is the council shall appoint. So there is it's not that we couldn't adopt that model, but and I don't have any problem with suggesting to people that you've got until X time to get a letter of interest and a resume, or if you want to have a formal application. I'm a little concerned about the time crunch. If we take a week to formulate what the application is going to say and get it approved and send, but we need to get a deadline set for the submission of application, statement of interest, resumes, or whatever. And I don't have any problem with you reviewing those and screening those and getting it down to maybe five or six qualified applicants. But I at that point, I think it's incumbent upon us to exercise the authority that's given us in the charter to perhaps conduct some interviews and in an open meeting, and then choose one through a more Iowa caucus process, perhaps, or something where there's votes taken as opposed to just approving a recommendation from you. Nothing against your judgment or anything else, and no offense taken, I hope, but I think it needs to be, and I've been through this once before, when Jim Bruner resigned to run for Congress, Board of Supervisors, we had a very open process where we had many applicants. We narrowed it down, and I said, I have no problem with you being the one to narrow it down. But I think if I'd like to have the opportunity to question people, and five of them maybe at the most, but that would be my preference. I don't want to, if I could continue to describe my ideal world, I think that would be nice if that application process suggested to people that they submit, three references of people who they've worked with or something like that. So if any of us are motivated to make phone calls and find out a little bit more about how they work in a team setting, how they work in a group, that kind of thing. And I don't want to get inundated with phone calls and letters of reference, because I just would like to avoid that process. So I think if we let people know, we can't stop people from sending letters, we can't stop people from making phone calls, but five letters of reference that are attached to the application or something like that would be the way I would prefer to do it. I personally don't think it needs to be a popularity contest, who can pull together the most letters of recommendation or the most phone calls or that type of thing. Because of what Claudia just indicated about the scope of the work that's going to be necessary for somebody to start from scratch, even if they've had involvement in the city, it's still a, there's a steep learning curve for new people. I'm not particularly anxious, and this is not so much process as it is just providing a little direction from one council member. I'm not particularly anxious to appoint somebody who is going to be running for that seat in March. I don't feel comfortable being a kingmaker or anointing somebody or giving somebody that big of an advantage. So again, I'm not sure that I would support anyone who was running in March, but I make that, that's just a personal comment. So, and of course, it's all complicated by the fact that I'm going to be out of town from the 12th to the 20th, which is when all this is going to happen. So you can ignore everything I just said. But that still gives us time to get it done by the 26th, which is when we have to have it done.
Right. So we'd need the 10th and 11th for interview days.
You could do that, yes. Or you could
book those,
put them on the 22nd if you'd like. Because
all right, other comments?
Just a question for city attorney. Qualified elector, other than the residency requirement, I'm assuming there would be no felony convictions, which would make them a qualified voter in order to hold the seat. Would that be the only thing that would be a prohibitive?
Yes, they have to be a qualified voter.
Okay. Kyle?
Just another clarification, too. The process here, we appoint somebody, and then they would, then there would be an election with March, which is the next regular election cycle. Now, would that individual be sworn in right after that election or wait till June when the others are?
The newly elected council member would be sworn in June. So the person that is appointed will serve from immediately after the appointment until June.
Okay. I want to make sure that's all clear and up front so everybody understands.
Okay.
And I I'm not sure that I want to put that stipulation of not being able to run because it's going to be filling a seat, and I know that it gives a little bit of an advantage, but I don't know that I want to put that stipulation on there.
No. I'm almost the opposite. If there's somebody that's really qualified out there and they really shine and they learn a lot, I think it's the Mesa's advantage. So I would encourage people that may have other desires to continue to serve to also apply. Just if it helps them, that's fine.
So they become an incumbent, which may not be the most advantage.
Whether that's helpful or not. Yeah. All right. If we are going to do an interview process, we're going to have to set up some time, in a half a day or something or whatever it is, because to go through 3 to 5 people and ask questions, you're going to have at least 15 minutes to half an hour apiece in order to give them some quality time. And I don't mind doing it that way. That way I don't...
that's what I was going to say. What about...
All right, let's check the other side here. Claudia?
I think I prefer the direction of having you go through that, go through the sifting process, do the interviewing, and making a recommendation to us. That doesn't mean, I mean, anywhere along the line, we can get all those applications, we can look at them. If we have concerns, you know, I that's an interesting issue, Debbie, about whether or not we could then convey any concerns at all to Keno. I mean, two of us could, right? how would that work?
In terms of an individual applicant?
Yeah.
Yes, we cannot. The open meeting law would prevent the mayor from taking input individually from all the different council members.
Yeah.
Unless an open meeting.
Unless an open meeting. In terms of qualifications, I think you can identify what the qualifications are, but talking about an individual person, and really you're talking about the qualifications here today, and that should take place in an open meeting. But in terms of responding to a specific person, the mayor could not entertain that information.
And if we had open meetings, I would assume that we would allow public participation, so supporters could come forward, and it would be hard to restrict.
Well, Mayor, since you are the decision maker in terms of running the meetings, you, and if you want to seek the input of the council, you can set what process will be followed during the open meeting in terms of receiving comment.
Okay. Well, I think we have an ordinance that takes five to overrule that vote. Okay.
May I?
Vice Mayor.
Let me just continue. If we go the direction of the direction that you were suggesting, Tom, of having Keno narrow it down, and I'm fine with your narrowing it down. I was fine with your narrowing it down to one and making a recommendation to the council. But if we do that, I think that we ought to have, in interviewing those folks, I think it ought to be less formal than us sitting here looking like the, you know, the Senate hearings, where were you on the night of June 24th? And we would, while it would have to be an open meeting, it doesn't have to be an open meeting here. We could do it, say, at Centennial Hall, have one of those rooms, and couldn't we?
Yes, you certainly could, Vice Mayor. The other thing I'm looking at, and I'm just looking at a treatise now, is could an interview be held in executive session? I'm not sure with an elected official whether council would even be inclined to. I'm not sure it permits it, but if council wants, I will go research that to determine that.
No, I wasn't thinking.
Interested in that.
Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't looking in that direction. I was just thinking that something less formal than this, you know, anybody in the public who wants to come, but not, you know, just saying, okay, you're on TV and you know, welcome to the world.
As long as it's posted, the location can change.
And it could be, and that way it could be a little less formal than this setting here, maybe a little less intimidating than this setting here. And if we did it as a study session, we could do those interviews without then taking public comment. We would take public comment when there was a vote, but we wouldn't take public comment during those interviews. You wouldn't have to vote on that same day.
Well, but when we vote, we'll have another open meeting, and
yes. We'll
have...
Absolutely.
Yeah, all right.
Absolutely.
The time frame on this is 30 days. So the resignation was on the 26th of September. That gives us the 25th of October would be the... So I'm trying to figure out a little time frame. So we're having the discussion on October 1st. I'm thinking of having applications for closing out the application process by the 9th or 10th. That gives about 3 or 4 days, and then so that we could get back to the 15th meeting of the council to kind of go through where it is so far. You've read all, everyone would know who all the applicants are. I will have done some pre-screening and have a recommendation. If something wants to change at that point and you're not comfortable with the way it's going, or we can't get to four votes, then we still have a little bit of time before the 25th, which is the deadline, to do it. And if we don't meet the 25th deadline, then we have to call a special election and pay for that. It's my understanding, and I don't think anybody wants to do that. So, yeah. Scott?
Actually, that's what I was thinking. I actually kind of like Tom's idea about bringing in maybe not five, but even two or three. Having you narrow it down to two or three will bring them in for some questioning, and that way we can have a discussion back and forth. We would have three candidates in front of us and make the selection there and get a vote. I'm pretty sure with two or three of them, we should be able to come to four votes. As far as an intimidating setting, I'm not too worried about it, because if they're intimidated over there, they ought to try this side of the bench.
Okay. All right. Well, we have to get to four on the process, so I'm not sure we're quite there yet. We got.
I would hope that we would have a short list without a recommendation first, and then have a chance to vet those individuals, and then you could. I mean, obviously, you have an opinion, but I would hate to have it come forward with your recommendation to solidify right off the bat that that's the person you want. Could you manage to do it that way?
Well, we have council meetings on the 1st and the 15th. All right, so today is discussion about how to do it. So we have a council meeting on the 15th. We have study sessions. We could always have a special council meeting to confirm, so I'm not too worried about the confirmation. We have study sessions currently set, obviously today, then we have the 4th, the 11th, the 15th, the 18th, and the 25th is drop dead day. So somehow we have to get to a point where we have a period of time, and I'm thinking probably at least till the 10th, 10th or 11th, and so that we could have a recommendation by the 15th, which is a study session.
Or a short list.
Or a short list, right. And then that gives us till the 18th, which is the next study session, to...
Which we could schedule interviews on the 18th, which would meet the time frame.
Okay.
If that would work. Are you here, Tom?
No.
All right, and then not have a vote until the 25th, or do interviews and vote on the 18th. Well, we have to get to four.
Right.
If we get to four, it doesn't make any difference.
Exactly, Mayor, that's what I was going to say. I don't have to be here on the 25th, but or on the 15th and the 18th. But if there's a not four votes by that time, and you need something by the 25th, then we can do it then. I did understand, though, that the 18th was being scheduled, sort of the study session was going to be the transportation road show. Yeah, this is probably more important.
Well, the council meeting of the 15th, we could probably do the interviews prior to that.
Out of New Orleans.
So we've got two missing on the 15th. Well, still have four left. We'd really have to be united, wouldn't we?
Wow.
Mayor, but didn't you say if you have a short list on the 15th, you could interview on the 18th and select on the 25th?
Yeah. Is Heidi here? Heidi, you want to come forward? I know we've worked together on this schedule to see whether we're doing something that's impossible as far as getting it.
Good afternoon.
So we're trying to do the time frame. If we announce today and we kind of agree that we're going to let it go on Channel 11 and hopefully we can get a press release out to the Republican Tribune and East Valley Independent so that they can let people, you know, they may, weekly paper might not work. And then we accept applications through, I'm saying probably like the 10th, 9th or 10th.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what days of the week they are. All right. We have a study session on the 11th. I don't know if we could shorten. That probably doesn't give enough time for applications to get the word out, though. All right. So I guess we would have to have everything in and be ready for the study session on the 15th.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're looking for with a short list of 3 to 5? 2 or 3? All right.
And that would be discussed at the study session right before the council meeting on the 15th? Or at the council meeting?
No, I would think we'd probably do it at the study session.
Okay.
And then we would move forward with interviews, I guess. What's Transportation Roadshow? Do we bump it or do
Mayor,
we do it on
yeah,
the
Yeah, Mayor, we
or?
Could. We You could, if the council would agree on the, if you can agree based on your recommendation or whatever, a short list of 3 on the 15th,
okay.
Then I think that would give us time to schedule those 3 to come and meet with the council on the morning of the 18th, and then that would give you another week after the interview to make a decision for the 25th.
Well, then why don't we have the list? We have to have everyone in by the, which would be the 10th, so we can tabulate by the 11th, so everyone will have the list of who has applied, and then from the 11th to the 15th, I'll do some interviewing and shortlist it down to 2 or 3 for the Monday the 15th.
I thought we were at 5.
Well, whatever you decide. You want to go to 5? I've heard 2 or 3 over here, and I hear... Why don't we do it from anywhere from 3 to...
3 to 5.
Just depends on how many...
Yeah, exactly, Bear. I would leave it in your discretion. If you find 4 outstanding candidates, I would hate for you to say, well, I'm limited to 3.
Okay.
But I don't... You know, more than 5 seems unnecessary. Less than 3 seems unduly restrictive.
Three to five.
Feel comfortable with 3 if that's all the quality
all right.
presents itself.
I hear enough 3 to 5, so let's lock in on that one. So it's okay? All right. So then the short list would be... released on the 15th?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yes. The council would agree to a short list. To be essentially agreeing to the list to be interviewed on the 18th. That's right. What you're doing on the 15th.
That's it.
And I will call in on that meeting.
All right. Okay. And then we would make the selection on the 18th?
Or the 25th, your choice, Mayor.
I'd just soon do the interviewing and make the selection. Unless there's some follow-up, that gives us till the 25th.
Yeah, the backup.
Gives us a little option if we want to. And it also then allows Tom to reappear on the 25th. Is everybody going to be here on the 25th? Well, let's go to the 25th then. Make the selection on the 25th. That way we'll have the full council here. Right, Tom?
And Mayor. The last second, you want an extra day just in case? In case you fumble?
I think actually you do have another, you do have, because you don't count the day of the resignation. So if you went the 27th, 28th, 29th, 30th, and then 26 more days is 30. So I think you actually do have the 26th.
I haven't actually counted the 30 days, Mayor, but Councilmember Rawls, I agree with him. You don't count the day of the resignation. Day one would be the day after.
So I think you.
Plenty of room.
Right. Stretch her out.
At least 48 hours.
And I may well call in on the 15th for the study session part as well.
Okay.
Depending on what happens. So, I mean, I'm not that lost this time.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
May I recommend then that we post a meeting for the 26th, just in case we have to have a meeting on the 26th, so that we don't end up in a place where we have not had a posted meeting and we have a problem?
Right. And my understanding is it's going to take 4 votes for concurrence. And if you don't get the 4 votes, then a special election is called, and you pay the 120 or whatever it is for a special election in District 5, and then they go through what, or how does that work?
Mayor, if you do not appoint within 30 days, you're right, a special election must be called, and it must be held within 120 days following the vacancy. And then the elected person will serve for the entire unexpired term. So if there's a special election, that person would serve until 2010.
Okay. All right, Tom.
So you'd have to have that special election by January 26th? You couldn't even bump it over till March.
No, the charter says it shall be held no later than 120 days following the occurrence of the vacancy.
That's special.
October. Yeah, so it would have to be roughly by January 26th. So we don't want that to happen, so we will reach concurrence.
Could you do it in November?
Yeah.
No, you couldn't have the filing period. They would have to have some period to make an application. Does everyone get listed? Is there a nomination petition process, or how does that work?
I haven't researched that far down there.
We would have to get to that point. They have to put signatures, just like a regular election.
Don't know. Want to try
Mayor,
that?
That's what happened last time. We're already making up the petitions, and the petitions state to fill the unexpired term, which will terminate actually in January 2011. Because the election dates will have changed by that time.
So is there a petition process where they'd have
yes,
to gather
is.
Signatures? How many days do they have to gather signatures?
Between November 12th and December 12th, and they have to come up with a minimum of 356 signatures.
Okay, so we couldn't, I was thinking we'd combine it with the November election with the county election and save the money. Can't do that.
Can't do that.
All right, okay. All right, so that's our choices. Any question on the outline?
Clarification. Right. They can submit the signatures between November 12th and December 12th, but they could start collecting signatures as soon as they filed an organizational a committee of organization.
They can start collecting them anytime they file a statement of organization, but they have to be submitted between the 15th
right.
November
I just wanted to clarify that,
yes.
That they could start collecting the signatures at any point
as soon
in
as
time.
That statement of organization.
So people right now, if somebody were interested in running for the District 5 seat in March, they could form a statement, they could form an organization tomorrow, they could come in and file with the city clerk's office, and they could begin collecting signatures.
That's correct, Vice Mayor.
Thank you.
Could they collect signatures, and then if we didn't make an appointment, they could run for that? Is that the same seat, or is that a different seat?
Like those things.
Different petition?
Different petition.
Different petition for them. Okay. All right. Because the time duration would be different. So they really have to wait until after October 26th to see if we make a decision. And then it's a different petition process because of...
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
They could take the risk.
All right. Okay. All right. It is fun.
Mayor?
Okay.
If you bring back the 3 to 5 recommendations on the 15th, then does the council also want to see all of those who have applied?
Yes.
So do you want to bring the list and then here are my 3 to 5?
The full list will be public record. I think the whole list should be brought to the council.
So it'll be brought to the council.
I was hoping that we would have the list
As soon as
it's submitted.
As soon as the deadline for the application?
Shortly thereafter.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Tom?
And the deadline we're setting is the 10th? Okay, what I would ask is, I'd like not just the list, but I'd like the whatever they submit by the end of the business on 11th, because I'm leaving on the 12th, so that I can take them and review them and...
Okay. And what about the application? Or do you want to come back to council and agree on that, or...
No, if we come back and agree on it, we're missing some of the application aspects of it. So I say we do the boards or committees, and we do some type of... Tom, what was your suggestion? One as far as what...
You had the suggestion that you wanted to have the opening, and why do you think your services... I didn't have any specific suggestion.
Okay, I guess it was Claudia as far as the...
Actually, it was three references.
Oh, yeah, three references. I thought it would be good.
And a maximum of 5 letters attached, I think you said, but, you know, obviously anybody can email us, or we prefer that you email or write a letter. This could get... That's what I was thinking. You add an extra week in there, and it's a week of everybody taking phone calls and...
Right. Now, as far as open meeting process goes, if I receive an email and it has to do with this appointment and it's coming to me, there's no reason I can't share it with the rest of the committee. I mean, the rest of the council.
Mayor, what I would recommend is if it comes, hopefully it will come by the 11th, and it can all be sent out to the council.
As part of that packet?
As part of the packet.
Okay. But all that can be shared because it's...
Yes.
All right.
Based upon my experience, it's extraordinarily unrealistic to expect that everybody is going to get their letters of recommendations or make their phone calls by the 11th. In fact, the process really isn't going to start until after the 11th. So I think you need to look at whether or not, if the mayor gets an email specifically for him, can he share it, or if any of us get an email, can we share it, realizing that we can't have any feedback back on it. We can't have any discussion, but can we... Here's Joe Blow's letter in support of candidate X. Can we share that?
Yeah. And yes, I think you can. It's the one-way communication I think the Attorney General's office provides. And also, we will be making that same email available to the press. As you know, your emails are made public, so we'll just make sure that every time there's a packet going out to the council, it's also made available to the press, and we'll make sure everybody gets it simultaneously.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
And we need to make that very, very clear to everybody on Channel 11, in the newspaper articles that are written about this. People cannot think that anything that they send to us will be confidential. None of it will be confidential, other than things like if you have a social security number. What else can we redact on there, Debbie?
Home address, phone number, any personal identification type information.
But other than personal identification information, I don't think you can... Can you do that on the home address aspect of it? Because that's a qualifying piece of information in terms of whether or not they're a candidate or not. I mean, you have to know where they live.
Well, I was actually... Yeah, I was thinking of the individuals who are sending you emails either supporting or opposing.
Ah,
you
know, okay.
In terms of the candidates, you're right. That is a qualifying piece of information.
Jason, if somebody sends me a letter and they have their address on it, on any topic, that becomes public only after we redact their address?
We do not redact every piece of email that comes to you. However, there is a new statute that was passed in the last legislative session that places an obligation on governmental entities to redact all personal identification type information. So there's kind of a conflict now, or it's still unsure.
From communications from the public to us?
It doesn't list that level of specificity. And there is still some debate in the public sector in terms of how do we reconcile the open meeting law or the public records law with that new piece of legislation.
And again, I would think that particularly since you're talking about an appointment to a particular district, one of the things that might be relevant is from where in the city or elsewhere is the support for a particular candidate coming. So to eliminate the address of the person who is writing a letter on behalf of a particular applicant seems to me to be problematic.
Mm-hmm.
We'll look at that and let you know as soon as we can.
Okay.
Okay, I'll work with the Public Information Office, and we'll start getting things together to let everyone know.
All right, sounds like 3 to 5. We've got a time frame. Let's open it up for applications as soon as we can, and we'll start doing some screening. All right, the next item is to hear an update and discuss collaboration between the police department and ICE. Chief Gascon?
Mr. Mayor. We have some folks from ICE here that are going to be joining, and I'm going to let them handle the PowerPoint.
Okay.
Mr. Mayor, members of council, we're here today to provide you an update from the last meeting that we had late last year concerning cooperation between ICE and the Mesa Police Department. And today with us, I have Mr. Alfonso Pena, who is the SAC for ICE here in the Phoenix area. Also, he has with him his assistant SAC, Ms. Pat Schmidt. And we have Mr. John Garullo, who is the Deputy Field Officer, Director of Detention and Removals. The goal here today is to have Mr. Pena give you a sort of a broad overview of both of, remind everybody what the functions of ICE are, and then go into the partnerships that we have developed since Mr. Pena and myself, since we got here about the same time, have developed some of the ongoing investigations, some of the things that we're seeing, and then turn it over to you for any questions and answers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief, for that introduction. And Mayor and Council, it's a privilege and a pleasure to be here before you again. As the Chief mentioned, I was here shortly after I arrived in Arizona. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to come speak to you again about our efforts. I kind of maybe want to start off preface by a story I just heard the other day, and I think it was Director Louis Free, when he was head of the FBI, had a son who was about in the third grade, and they one of the kids, his son asked him if he could bring his class into the FBI office for a tour of the building. And Director Free agreed to do that, and these students were in there, and they were looking, getting a tour of the building. And one of the things that they were showing was the 10 most wanted, the pictures of the 10 most wanted fugitives that the FBI hunts down. And he was explaining how these were the most dangerous criminals and how the FBI is looking for them, and how important it was to find these people. And one of the little kids raised his hand and asked Director Free, he said, "Well, I got a question, sir. I mean, you said these are the most, important people that you're looking for, and there are these bad criminals." That said, "Just my question is, why didn't you guys arrest them when you were taking their picture?" sometimes I think, I think kind of maybe the analogy is that, this immigration piece is extremely difficult, and sometimes I think people think it maybe is a little simpler than it is, and I hope what I present to you today we'll demonstrate some of the complexities of what we're encountered. It's really extremely a complex deal, but it, on the surface, maybe sometimes it seems very, very apparent that it could be much easier, but hopefully the information I'll present to you will help clarify that. Again, thank you very much for having me. Our agency, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, we've been around since 2003. Our mandate was they brought in agents from the Immigration Service and agents from the Customs Service, merges into one agency. And part of that, there are several components of ICE, which John is here to represent detention and removals. I'm here to represent the Office of Investigation. What we do are criminal investigations that target the offenders that are violating the immigration law. John will talk to you a little bit about what detention and removal does. Everything I do is going to be criminal. Everything we do, and mainly with the police department and with other agencies, deals with a criminal investigation. John's agency, and I'll let him talk a little bit more about it, it doesn't necessarily require a felony criminal case and the activity that they're involved in. Just kind of to succinctly say what we do and our mission is, if it moves across the border, we have jurisdiction to investigate. If it's people or things, anything that crosses the border, legal or illegal, we investigate. We have authority to investigate. And that's just about, whether it's people or things, contraband, legal merchandise, to make sure duties are collected, we have authority, people, whether they're coming in legally, the people that come in illegally, anything that crosses the border, and no matter how it crosses, whether it comes under a tunnel illegally, as we discovered recently in Yuma, if it comes through cyber, anything that enters the United States, we have jurisdiction to investigate. Some of our priorities for the Office of Investigation, high priorities, and there's none of these, the way they're listed, that doesn't mean they're in that priority order, but these are some of the most important things we look at as criminal investigation, human smuggling, big problem, major money laundering, document fraud. Document fraud probably facilitates a lot of this criminal activity. Our strategic program is, that's where we, again, talked about whatever crosses the border. We want to make sure technology from the United States doesn't leave and go to countries that are not friendly with us. We work child pornography. A lot of that is through the internet, cyber crimes, commercial fraud, commercial trade. We believe one of the big things we have to do, we have such a broad authority and jurisdiction, is to have partnerships with state and local law enforcement. That's, again, we have a great partnership and a great relationship here with the Phoenix Mesa Police Department. One of our big priorities is worksite enforcement. That is where, that's going after the magnet that's bringing a lot of the illegal aliens into the country. That's a big priority of ours as well. Best Task Force, that's a task force that was set up by ICE. It's the Department of Homeland Security. It's led by our organization. It brings federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies and with participation of the community to try. And the mission is to improve public safety in communities. And every community, each community may be something different. It's not one size is going to fit all. Some communities want a little more aggressive effort. Some others have certain relationships that doesn't work for them. We don't force what we do on anybody. We say, this is what we have to offer. If you want to participate with us, we're willing to work with you and what best fits your community. Part of this Border Enforcement Security Task Force is a concept where ICE is taking the lead role, leadership, saying there's so many agencies, and you can see from this diagram of the different entities within Arizona that are involved in one way or another dealing with this illegal immigration problem. And we're trying to make sure that there's a coordination of this, that it's not just independently, there's collaboration, there's deconfliction, there's a pointer. If one agency is working in an organization, there's a way that another agency is aware of that, and we can best coordinate that information. And here, what we do here, and I'm just not going to go through all the agencies, but we do work very closely with the Mesa PD Metro Task Force. That's where the coordination is, the primary coordination with Mesa Police Department. Okay. This is, again, what we see the most difficult and most challenging is the violence that's associated with the illegal activity involving with illegal immigration. There's a term that's on there. The first one is bajadores. That's ripoffs. That term has been coined here in Arizona. It doesn't exist. It didn't exist anywhere else. It's starting to exist in other places where one smuggler will go rip off a load of aliens from another smuggler instead of going down to the border and smuggling them up. It's so profitable now. They'll just look for a drop house here. They'll see a vehicle coming up the road, and they'll go rip them off. And they'll tell those aliens, you paid that smuggler, but now you're going to pay me, and they're going to hold them hostage. We had homicide cases, rapes of women that are brought up, aggravated assaults where they hold them in the stash houses, hostage cases where they're told, you're going to pay me X number of dollars. Then they want more money. They extort money from them. Vehicle rollovers, cities are encountering and communities are counting, where they overload these vehicles. They come up. If a police officer tries to stop them, they run from the police. Many times those vehicles are so unsafe, they roll over. None of the people are in there. You've got dozens of people with no seat belts, and the drop house. And as you can see from these pictures, this is the kind of equipment that we encounter when we go into these houses. Here, just to give you kind of a snapshot, and this we go from fiscal year October to September. Alone, there was 156 drop houses in the valley area. Of those, there was 83 criminal arrests, and over 3,000 aliens, illegal aliens, that were apprehended in these drop houses. The hostage cases, those were 23 cases where actually somebody was being held and that harm was going to come to them. And fortunately, in every one of those cases, we were able to rescue those victims. But I wanted to point out that of those, there was 25 of these cases in Mesa, which we worked very closely with the police department. It's the second only to Phoenix is the number one location with these drop houses. And those drop houses range from anywhere between, probably on the low side, a little under 20, to the high side, to about 200. We had one case in Scottsdale with over 200 people being held. These are some incidents of violence right here in Mesa, the dates of when they took place and the cooperation between our agencies. May 23rd, Mesa PD were notified of a homicide. It was involving illegal aliens, and we responded. One of the things that we bring to the table is through our databases, we can help identify somebody. A lot of these people, there's no identification document with them, so when a homicide detective is going to start his case, he doesn't know who his victim is. So we can come in through we can do a mobile fingerprinting, and we can find out who that person is. That helps the homicide investigator start their case right away, because they're going to follow up, who is this person, who's he been associated with. Those are going to be the leads. They're going to help them solve their homicide. It's going to help us identify what organization these people were involved in, what smuggling groups operate in the area. So it's a win-win for both agencies. So second major case, big case involving violence. It was the one about which we're investigating currently. This is still ongoing, where there's been two female Guatemalans that have been found in the city of Mesa that were smuggled up into to the community, and they were going to go further on, but they were not planning to stay in Mesa, but the bodies were recovered here, and we're working very closely with the police department on that. 287G, this is a program that I think a lot of you have possibly heard of. It's a program where it allows the federal law enforcement under immigration and customs enforcement to train either detention officers in institutions and jails or task force officers. But what I want to bring this out and talk to you a little bit about it, more to say that this is just one of many things that we can offer a law enforcement agency in their community. It's not the only thing, and sometimes this doesn't fit every community. And currently right now, it is not being funded. We're not bringing any new agencies on under the 287G. Unfortunately, Congress has not allotted us additional money to continue the program, so those agencies that were not on board, there's going to be a pending period before new agencies can come back on board. But again, it's not some of the other things that we have. It's a program called Access, and that's where we have subject matter expertise. If you're having if your community is experiencing human trafficking, human smuggling, we can come in and work with you. And that's kind of the current partnership we have with the Mesa Police Department. We work. We have an operation targeting gang. We do, because of our customs authority as well as our immigration authority, they don't have to be foreign national gang members. We can come after gang members if they're involved in narcotics. We can come after them if they're illegally in the country. We have many ways we can go after gang members that are in your community. And we have a proposed operation that we're going to be working very closely with the chief's office that's going to be targeting gang members here in this community. We're going to use all of our tools, all of our authorities, and an operation that we're planning here in the near future. Worksite enforcement, we do the outreach. We try to educate companies that want to practice due diligence on what they need to do to avoid running into problems of having employees that kind of workforce that they don't want to have. We have a document, one of the best fraudulent document laboratories in the nation. We make it available to state and locals when they want any kind of assistance. We can provide them when they may have a problem that people are presenting documents and they need some expertise. And another big operation, this is one we're very closely aligned with Mesa, is on our financial, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, because there's a big case that we're working here in your community involving proceeds that are generated from this criminal activity. Some of the ICE and Mesa collaborations, Operation Coyote Inn was an operation involving hotels in the Mesa area that were being used as stash houses, and I'm going to go into details on that here in just a few minutes. We currently have a money laundering investigation that is probably traced, and it's based here in Mason. I cannot talk to you in detail because it's an ongoing case, but we've traced over $30 million going back to a country that we know is proceeds from illegal alien, and it's based, that investigation, the primary suspect is based here in Mesa. We're working, as I said earlier, about the arrest of murder suspects. We have a detective assigned to our department to work with us, and he's working on that case involving the $30 million. He's working with us on that case, providing tremendous assistance to us. As I mentioned, we're planning this gang operation to come after, which the police department has identified gang members. They have packages for these people. We will be targeting them together. A little bit about that Coyote Inn. Here's a list of the motels. The motels were fined for doing this, $1.5 million. Of that money, $390,000 was shared back to Mesa Police Department for their participation. These are the hotels that, and what each one, and motels, what they paid. But again, that money came back to your community for the assistance that was provided to ICE in this investigation. This is going to, again, just, I cannot go into more details about this case, but it's a human smuggling case based here, orchestrated here in Mesa, Arizona. They utilize unlicensed money remitters for this, and we have traced approximately $30 million. They're going out of the United States. There's proceeds that's involved in this type of activity, and they're smuggling. We know at least we can document over 1,000 illegal aliens that have been smuggled into the United States by this group. Now I'm going to turn it over to John to talk about detention and removal.
Thank you. I'm here representing Detention Removal Operations. We're the Uniform Division of ICE. When you think of ICE, you can think of investigations, more as your detective, investigators, where their main purpose, do criminal investigations, put people behind bars. Our folks is a little different. We're the uniformed responders, and we actually remove everybody from the United States once they're done with their prison time. We promote the public safety and national security by ensuring those rules, the departure from the United States, through the fair enforcement of immigration laws, which are administrative but can also go criminal. So there's sometimes some confusion there. Some of our priorities is 100% detention of nationals from countries. Anybody the Border Patrol arrests, anybody arrested here in the Arizona, ends up coming to our two detention centers, either in Eloy or Florence, Arizona. We also assist other DHS entities. We work very closely with office investigations in regards to arresting, apprehending all aliens, any assistance they may need, along with the local law enforcement agencies. On September 4th, 2006, we actually took over primary response from the office investigations, which just made perfect sense for both our agencies. Their OI is mainly focused on criminal investigations. Why do you want to tie them up with more administrative matters that just go into immigration violations? That's where our office comes in. That's where our main focus. We do have officers available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to respond to local law enforcement agencies. Any of these calls that come in, they develop any type of smuggling, any type of weapons violations, anything that goes beyond administrative processing. We work closely with investigations and we do a joint response where detention removal handles the administrative or the immigration violations and the office investigations handle the criminal violations. Since September 4th, 2006 to present, we have received 71 calls for assistance from the Mesa Police Department. In all but one of those calls, we actually responded. The one call we did not respond was the police officer on scene got a higher priority call and had to leave. From those calls, we arrested 440 illegal aliens from these calls. Again, this is a resource available to your community that if you call us, we are going to respond and for the immigration administrative violations. That's mainly what our division does. Again, that's something that we're going to continue to work with whatever you as a community decide to work with.
Again, in conclusion, again, we believe we have a very, very healthy relationship with the Mesa Police Department under the excellent leadership of Chief Gascon. We have a very, you know, ongoing plan of go after some gang members in the community. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that he's identified a problem in your community with these gang members, bringing our resources to bear on them. We're looking forward to doing that because his success, your success in getting these people out of the community is our success as well, because our mission is to improve the public safety and the quality of life in the state of Arizona. And we're going to do it, you know, with partnerships. We can't do it alone. We don't have the resources, but we do have tremendous authorities that we can bring to bear. So we thank you for your time and allowing us to come talk to you about what our missions are. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, now we're open for any questions that you or other council members may have.
Chief, I think that in an earlier discussion, there was some thought process to doing something in the jails to do a quicker process, and I don't know if it was a 287G embedded, trained, so that we could ask some questions when people are being brought through the jail system originally. Is that still a possibility, or is that with lack of funding that can't go forward, or where's that at?
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, and the problem is currently the lack of funding from ICE. We have discussed doing a 287G training in our for our detention officers in the jail so that we can process criminal illegal aliens other than the unauthorized entry into the country quicker through the process. Currently, we're unable to do so because ICE does not have the funds to train folks. It must be stated, though, that if it's an incident that leads to a detention at the Maricopa County Jail, then obviously the Sheriff Department is doing 287G work with anyone that goes through the jail system.
Okay, I know we had a discussion almost a year ago because I pulled up the minutes from October 5th, 2006, yep, where we talked about different programs that we might want to do to address the issue of immigration, and since then, I guess Congress's inaction has continued, so I think there's a little bit more frustration level, at least on my part, and I was hoping that that program would still be available and we could discuss it as a council and move forward with doing that in the booking facilities here in Mesa. But I still have to have council concurrence. If funding became available at some future date, is this still a possibility, or is it really a door that's closed?
No, I don't believe it's closed completely. Just coincidentally today, the assistant secretary, that's my boss out of Washington, D.C., was in town to speak to a North American Free Trade Zone meeting that was at the Biltmore today, and her and I met prior to that with the governor. That was the same question from the governor, was interested in 287G, and the answer was, unfortunately, currently it's not funded to where we can expand on it, but the idea, it is a good program, it's an effective program for those communities that believe it tailors their needs, and I would believe that in the future that it will be funded again at some point in time. So to answer your question, I do not believe it's permanently closed, that it won't open up again, but right now, at this time, only those agencies that had requests in are going to be processed.
Okay, and I think there's, 71 cities in the United States that have that type of program, or have the research?
I know there's a fact sheet online, and unfortunately, Mayor, I'm not.
Okay. Well, I'd like to at least put it on as a future council discussion item so that we could be in line if funding becomes available again to pursue that. Hopefully there's been a change of heart. I know we had a 5-2 vote the last time this came up as a council to not enter into any training through that program, but with the inaction of the federal government, I think we need to do something, and especially with our jail costs, if this will expedite the removal of some of our detainees, I think it would be beneficial financially also.
And that's why I hopefully in my message today is that 287G is one program. We have others. We have the Law Enforcement Support Center. We have John's Lear unit that will respond to calls from the police departments and stuff. So, again, we will bring what we have. Unfortunately, maybe 287G isn't one that we can offer right now, but we believe, and again, we will work very closely with the chief and your community, what we do have available to bring that forward to your department.
The other issue that came up that we didn't understand, that our police department couldn't access from our terminal, is your database. Has that now been corrected, or are we still in a similar situation?
Well, Mr. Mayor, we have corrected that. We can access that from several points. We cannot access it from the streets currently, and there are some technical areas that I believe that Cheryl Butler is here, that perhaps he can help us on that. But I think there's another important point to note here is that, frankly, if we reduce the cash and release program that we currently have in Mesa, and if we can process more people through our jail, and if we can fingerprint people before we release them, mm-hmm, we will be able to tell people that are wanted by ICE, regardless of whether we have 287G training or not. We have a bigger problem, quite frankly, than the 287G training. The problem that we have is we're releasing way too many people that we don't know who they are, because we don't have the ability to hold him, and we can't afford to take him to the Maricopa County Jail because the costs are so expensive. So I think if we could find a way to detain and process everybody that we put our hands on, you would see a tremendous amount of results out of that. that would far exceed anything that 287G and the jail can do for us.
Okay. Questions? Mike?
Agent Pena, thank you for your presentation. There's some indication on workplace enforcement that the department was preparing a list of non-matches of Social Security numbers. Where's that program today? Do you know?
Unfortunately, there's a lawsuit filed, I believe, by the AFL-CIO out of the district in Seattle, Washington. And based on that lawsuit,
There's probably a lot of adjectives you could use for that, sir.
So basically, they're telling us we can't send those letters out yet until this lawsuit's resolved. And it's on an expedited track. The Department of Justice has attorneys working on it. And hopefully it will be resolved and favorably, and we will be able to provide that information to employers. Because what that does for us, the element of proof on a worksite case is rather difficult. We have to prove that these companies knowingly or intentionally hired these people. And the way the statute is, pretty much they can present the documents. If they presented you a document and you said you thought it looked okay, you know, you're pretty much, use that as cover. These letters are going to clearly state these people, there's a no match, you need to take these actions to correct that. And if you don't, that can be constructive knowledge that you've been put on notice that you have someone. So that would be very favorable for us, and we're hoping for a favorable outcome on that litigation.
Thank you.
Kyle?
My question, well, there's two questions. One, the 71 calls from Mesa PD to ICE, what were those based on? Were those drop houses? What type of incidents?
Yes, primarily drop houses, or there were other predicate criminal activity.
Okay, and then the other issue then, the 287G, for the benefit of the public and the media that listens, what will 287G do for you that we cannot do right now? Because you're saying if we could detain and fingerprint, you could hold them long enough for ICE to come get them. So what does 287G do?
That's correct. Not only could we hold them, but we will be able to identify people that have been placed into the NCIC system as wanted for illegal reentry or other felony offenses. It will not address many of the administrative issues concerning immigration, but it will certainly address those criminals that are wanted for other predicate offenses. But I'll let Mr. Pena talk about the 287G training.
Yeah, what benefit does the 287G give to those officers who receive the training?
What it does, it's really it's a force multiplier for us, where we cannot be in your jail, where you have criminals coming out of your jail or people that committed offenses. If we can't have somebody there to interview anybody who identifies himself at the time of booking or processing as a foreign national, those people sometimes end up in the community and they are illegally. And this program is designed to have, we don't have the resources to bring to every jail and every city and every community. If those agencies elect to have that on their own, they can have somebody there. They can have their officers. They have the authority. They have the training, and they can process and do the processing themselves. Is there anything else on that, John, that I need to add?
I think you need to realize is that we already capture most of the criminal aliens through Maricopa County. The chief has the option to call us. As we've mentioned, we've responded 71 times. Most of them are involved in some type of criminal element where the chief said, you know what, this is a good determination, turn them over to ICE. And we are responsive, and we're going to continue to be responsive. The 287G program works great with some of the more serious offenders, but I think the chief was saying what happens when we respond to these illegal aliens, we bring them back to our office. We do the same thing as the chief was saying. We actually do 10 fingerprints, and then we know this individual, even though he's here in the country illegally, he was a serious criminal that was previously deported. We do not know that until we check biometrics. Something like that would ensure that no criminal aliens actually gets through your jail, which may be more of a focus, a higher priority on that, as opposed to catching every illegal alien.
So, but 287G just gives them the authority to do the interviewing and say, who are you, as opposed to?
They would actually do the interviewing, placing them under arrest for immigration, administration violations, and the actual processing. Along 287G also comes the transportation part of it, where the agency or your city would actually be responsible for bringing them after they are processed to our agency, which is in downtown Central Phoenix.
But the other option then being is if we could fingerprint more and there's a match, you can hold them and no questions asked.
Correct. And that is really where I think we need to go. That's why we want to talk about additional detention capabilities, because we really have to reduce the catch and release problem. perfect example, and it's not so much of an immigration problem as it is the failure to be able to identify people, was the recent killing of a Phoenix officer. The inability to identify people quickly to see whether they are lying to you is something that is holding Mesa Police Department and many other agencies in the area. People do not like to tell us the truth as to who they are. It doesn't matter whether they're here illegally or not. You know, criminals like to use multiple names. They use multiple identifications. And quite frankly, the only piece of technology that we have today available to us to be able to secure that information is through a fingerprint process, assuming that they have been arrested or they have been fingerprinted in some other before. But most of the people that we deal with are repeat offenders that have, and I'm talking about now the most of the criminal element, they are repeat offenders. As a matter of fact, we have been very successful in reducing serious crime in the city for the last 13 or 14 months. We are 5% down total Part 1 crimes year to date. We closed last year with nearly 15%, and most of it was, quite frankly, accelerated in the last few months of the year. Part of that is because our people are working very hard. But the other part is that they're also becoming much more smarter about what we do. We're focusing on the repeat offenders. We're focusing on that 10% that continuously commits crimes over and over again. So the ability to be able to tell who you are when we stop you and when we conduct the investigation has a tremendous force for us. And it becomes a force multiplier for us because we're not rearresting someone over and over again that should have been arrested and quite frankly convicted at an earlier instance.
Okay. We have a meeting that takes place. It's supposed to start at 5:45. Why don't we let everyone know that we'll start that at 6? We have an extra 15 minutes upstairs. I do have one request to speak here under public opinion appearances, but let's see if we can wrap this up. Vice Mayor and then Tom.
Thank you, Mayor. I appreciate your having coming back to report to us again. The last time we had a report, some time ago actually, we had some concerns because when we were calling ICE, we weren't always getting a response. Unfortunately, we were being told that you didn't have anybody to send out to collect people, and that was really concerning to us. So your statistics here are really amazing and quite an improvement, so thank you very much for that enforcement that you're doing. I want to clarify a couple of points. Chief, you referred to catch and release, and when you talk about catch and release in this context, you aren't talking about catching people who you presume to be illegally in the country and then releasing them. You're talking about catching people who you think have shoplifted or petty crimes of some type. You then hand them a traffic ticket. Would you explain that, please?
Sure, that's correct, Vice Mayor. We're talking about people that we come in contact with for minor violations. They give us an identification or they give us a name, and we have no way of verifying that. And all we have is the predicate offense is a very low-grade misdemeanor or an infraction, and we end up citing those people based on the identification they're providing us. Frankly, if you look at our statistics, there is many there are many more people from other groups than there are Hispanics in this, but proportionally, we're releasing a lot of people that shouldn't be released probably and wouldn't be released had we identified them, fingerprinted them, and assess who they really are. And that is a problem that today we're releasing folks because we only have 27 spaces in our detention facility, so it becomes full very quickly. Many times we're also trying to assess the cost of transporting somebody to Phoenix depending on the time of the day. Because frankly, it's becoming almost a 3 to 4 hour process for an officer to leave Mesa and go to Phoenix and book someone. So we know that when an officer leaves here, we lose him for most of the day. We have a transportation detail that has alleviated that, but sometimes you just have to take him. So there are many reasons why our people sometimes are very hesitant to book somebody, and when they have those low grade misdemeanors and infractions that would otherwise would warrant a little more attention, they're being cited based on the information that we're being provided on the street.
Thank you. A quick comment and then a question. I think that we should add our voice to asking our senators, our congressmen, to add funding again for this program because I think we need our jail folks trained in it. I'm very frustrated with the failure of the Congress to act in terms of dealing with these issues, but to not have the funding for the program just doesn't even make sense to me. So I think we need to add our voice to that. Then the second question I had is there such a thing as an asset forfeiture fund when it comes to things like you were talking about that thing that you're working right now where there's money that's flowing out of a criminal entity here? Can you seize those funds and use them for this very kind of training?
We do seize funds, and there is an asset forfeiture provision. It doesn't. I'm not aware that it goes back into the 287G program, but we do have it's the money and the proceeds that we seize, especially when it's cooperative law enforcement. We try to make sure that a percentage goes back to those communities to for law enforcement purpose. But I'm not aware that it funds the 287G program.
Tom?
I appreciate the presentation and you coming down. I'm going to sort of shift my attention to the chief for a minute, then I probably will come back to you. Following up on the catch and release program, chief, there's I understand what you're trying to do, and I think that you would admit that most of the things that you've tried to do since you got here, I've been a supporter of. I'm a little concerned that we're going to get too anxious to send people charged with minor offenses down to Sheriff Joe's jail. I don't want that to be the default position of this community, because there are a lot of people who commit, for whatever reason, low-grade crimes that have no business being introduced into that environment. Yep. And I just want to urge you to strike a balance here, because I have heard too many stories. I have encountered too many people who have, once having entered that environment, have never been the same.
And Councilmember Rawls, you're absolutely right. And the goal would not be to introduce these people into the jail system. The goal would be to positively identify them, and then those that should be released, knowing that we know who we're releasing now. Frankly, some of the things that are going to be on the table very shortly for you is going to be the whole concept of how do we create an arraignment center that will allow us to process people that will be completely handled in the entry level. There is no intention of increasing incarceration for people that shouldn't be incarcerated. The question, and it is one of balance, it's always, do we release people that should not have been released? And knowing who you have presently with you is critical to that process. It's not necessarily that we want to incarcerate more people. I'm not necessarily a fan of incarcerating people other than those people that need to be incarcerated as defined by those that are committing all the other crimes like robbery, murder,
exactly.
Rapes, and all that other stuff.
The violent offenders who...
Or even property.
Entry into Sheriff Joe's facility is not necessarily a step down for them. Let me just say that I think that we do need to talk and move forward on the arraignment center that we have discussed. I understand what you're trying to do. I was just trying to, because we've had this conversation sort of three times now recently. I think once at the public or the police, what's it called now, the Public Safety Committee,
yes.
And twice here at a study session where you've made reference to this problem, and I recognize the problem, and I certainly don't want to do anything to facilitate the release of criminals and violent criminals, but at the same time, and this is something that the people from ICE have to deal with all the time, you don't want to spread your net so wide that you capture unnecessarily the innocent or the people who shouldn't be exposed to that kind of environment. So
it's a balancing act, and you know, there are several things that we're doing at the same time. We're increasing Fourth Amendment training for our personnel. We have tightened up what we do in the jail. We have a supervisor there all the time. So we are doing a lot of other things to ensure that the people that do get arrested are the right people and the people that get booked are the right people, and that we're processing them according to the rules.
This was nothing more than sort of my word of caution that we don't get too aggressive in stepping over the line, because it can ruin people's lives just as easily as letting somebody go that shouldn't.
Absolutely.
And so I just wanted to echo that. And again, to the people from ICE, I guess one of my questions is on the funding issue. We're October 1st. Your fiscal year is October 1st to September 30th. I haven't read the newspaper recently, but I would be enormously surprised if Congress has actually adopted the budget for FY '07-'08. They normally don't do that until 3 or 4 years afterwards, but is there any hope, as you see it, and I know that there's the trouble with, you know, like we could discuss all the competing needs for money at the federal level, but is it, you didn't want to close the door permanently, Agent Pena, but I did get the impression that you weren't optimistic that any additional funding would be coming forth in the fiscal '07-'08 budget.
You hit it very well, Councilmember Rawls, is that we're going to be in a continuing resolution. We've already been told how long that's going to go, that will only be mission essential funding, expenditures approved. I know that the '08 budget is out there. From what I understand, they're not going to be bringing on the conversations I've had with the programs that run the 287G program was for us to go out and basically try to encourage communities and departments to go look for other avenues and not 287G.
Not 287G.
So I'm not optimistic that it's going to open anytime soon.
Mayor, that sort of gets me to the fact that this council is going to change so dramatically before fiscal year 08-09. I'm not sure that it's more than a exercise in futility for us to do much. But again, if it's there are times when you do symbolic things. So just look at my voting record. I mean. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much for coming.
Oh, yeah, thank you for having us.
Number five is acknowledging receipts of boards and committees. Motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Approved. Your reports on meetings. Let's skip that one. Scheduling and meetings and general information. Mr. Brady.
We'll see you on Thursday, 7:30, October 4th.
All right. Pre-scheduled. You have a question?
I won't be here Thursday.
Okay. Pre-scheduled, we do have one request to speak from Aaron Henderson. Aaron here. The topic is pellet guns and a playground in her neighborhood. Aaron, you have 3 minutes to address the council.
I hope I can speak quickly, Mr. Mayor, council members. My name is Aaron Henderson. I live at 630 West 2nd Street in Mesa. I'm a hospice nurse, a mother, a grandmother, and as a private nurse, I had the privilege of nursing ex-former chief Leonard Kotzer the last year of his life. It was a fantastic experience for me. First, I'll read my letter for anyone who hasn't read it or hasn't seen it. Over the past 22 months, since new renters moved into 620 West 2nd Street, owned by Mitzi Bolkin, we, Aaron Henderson and Nancy Burns, who was unable to be here tonight, she's at work, I found it necessary to call the police 3 times regarding gunshots or shooting. The most recent event was Sunday, August 19th, when we observed 3 boys shooting a large black gun at Birds. Oh, I'm sorry. At Birds in their backyard. This turned out to be a pellet gun crafted to resemble an assault weapon. If you take it out of the package, they come clear and the boys paint them black because they want them to look like a real gun, of course. Our dog has been shot at. She's an adopted female greyhound. She loves people. She's been hesitant to go out into the yard from being shot at. I have found rocks, parts of wrench sets, golf balls, assorted metal items in our backyard from these boys and their friends when they're playing in their yard. About 100 nails were found at the end of the driveway of the person renting the back half of our house. We have a duplex, which we believe the boys placed there. When a police officer was dispatched to the house in question, 620 West 2nd Street on August 19th, she informed us that pellet guns were legal. But if a police officer confronts a child or a teen who is wrongly supposed to be in possession of a real gun, now these toys are made to resemble real guns, in the space of a few seconds, a life could be taken or an injury done to that child. And the police officer told me they all like to go home at night themselves. Foolish boys could very easily be imagined to believe it would be funny or cruel to point such a toy gun at a police officer. Now, this side is what you buy. This side is what the police officer sees in a shady backyard on a Sunday afternoon. Those boys had guns drawn on them, and I don't know what condition their trousers were in when it was over, but the police were nervous wrecks. They had almost shot a child. We believe there's a place for guns in this city and county in the hands of police, armed service personnel, hunters behaving legally and responsible, and ranchers protecting livestock, one of which I used to be, and we had rifles to protect our livestock. We believe the city council should pass a law as quickly as possible to ban these dangerous toys before a child is injured.
I have a copy of that letter. Could we have a copy and we'll get it to all the council members? We have a council meeting that starts in 5 minutes.
Okay.
And your three-minute time limit is up, so if you can just conclude, please.
I will conclude by just saying I want a playground put in our neighborhood because these children are from lower-income families who can't really afford any other kind of entertainment. There is a vacant two-lot space on University and Date, which is possibly can be recoded to become a playground, fenced with a safe gate, and this would give the children something to do, basketball hoop, playground equipment.
Okay, thank you for your comments. The study session is adjourned. We'll reconvene upstairs once they get the cable switched over.